scientists were determined to adopt the same synergy in other fields as well.
The 17th meeting of the Joint Economic Commission of the two countries was held in Havana in December 2016, shortly after the conclusion of the 2015 deal between Iran and the P5 plus 1. Everything was going to change for better, but the reimposition of sanctions on Iran in 2018, following the U.S. pullout from the deal, killed all chances for Iran and Cuba to do business smoothly.
Despite their long-standing ties in scientific and political areas, Tehran and Havana have not done well when it comes to bilateral trade. Last year, Iran's exports to Cuba were almost zero, with its imports standing at a trivial $2,500. Both sides are now poised to give it a jump start, but they need to overcome stringent U.S. sanctions targeting both countries.
Cruel and inhumane was how the two officials described U.S. sanctions. However, both are determined to, quote, neutralize the embargoes using non-dollar channels such as bartering.
Iran and Cuba's common enemies will never succeed in trying to stop our revolutionary development. We will work together with Iran to adopt bartering and other banking mechanisms that will render ineffective and United States' illegal and unilateral economic measures against our nations.
Based on Cabrisa's three-day itinerary, the two sides will sign agreements in the fields of oil and petrochemical industry, mining and nanotechnology, among others. Closer ties with Cuba, among other Latin American countries, come as part of Iranian President Ebrahim Raisi's new approach toward foreign policy and his attempt to avoid tying the economy to the 2015 deal. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
A 74-second siren was sounded across the West Bank at 12 noon local time, marking the 74 years that have passed since their Nakba, the catastrophe. Demonstrators from all walks of life and of all ages held maps of historical Palestine and large metal keys to symbolize their homes from which were forced to leave decades ago. The anniversary also comes as anger is boiling over the Israeli killing of prominent Al Jazeera veteran journalist Shirin Abu Akleh.
Nakba anniversary has always been painful to all the Palestinians, and this year is more painful. Like every year, we commemorate our Nakba to tell the world that our homeland is unforgettable. That's why you can see people are still holding the keys to their ancestors' homes, as they still believe that they will return to their homes one day, and hopefully it'll be very soon.
Nearly 5 million Palestinian refugees remain scattered in different camps in the besieged Gaza Strip, the occupied West Bank and Al-Quds, Lebanon, Jordan and Syria, including others dispersed around the world. All of them have a mutual dream, which is returning to historical Palestine.
Since 1948, Palestinians have remained steadfast in defending their right to return to their homeland despite Israel's continued ethnic cleansing policies. For Palestinians, Nakba remains a painful episode in history, and the agony continues to be felt amid Israel's escalated violence and crimes. Mona Qandil, Occupied Ramallah.
Yet again, London's streets have been brought to a standstill by pro-Palestinian activists calling for an end to Israeli crimes against humanity in the occupied territories. Such events are building momentum, and the calls for the last apartheid on earth to be dismantled are growing louder.
Atrocities are committed in the occupied Palestinian territories on a daily basis, from ethnic cleansing to murder. And for decades, Western media has managed to downplay the severity of the situation. But now, with social media and so many cameras recording the madness, it's almost impossible to bury the truth.
Only days earlier, a prominent Palestinian journalist died when she was shot in the face by Israeli forces. She was reporting on an army raid in the West Bank. Her death caused outrage, and scenes of her coffin bearers being beaten by Israelis made headlines. 229 rights groups have called for Israel to be held accountable for what they call a premeditated assassination. At Saturday's protest, Shirin Abu Akleh's life and work was honoured.
I feel that we have the duty to come here and to do that and to speak out. For example, just Shireen the other day was murdered, and the news channels, they're reporting it as clashes. Even in her funeral, the clips that I saw were disgusting. And still, again, the way that they are being reported is as clashes. Now, Germany, they wanted to hold a protest for the murdered journalist, but Germany was not allowing them to do so.
There is a trade relation between Britain and Israel, which includes arms sales. So this country, Britain, buys armaments from Israel, which are being announced as tested on Palestinian people. So people always think that Britain is arming Israel, but it is not a one-way street. Britain is also buying arms from Israeli arms companies. And there are Israeli arms companies who are operating in Britain as well. They are producing in Britain.
A raft of new measures limiting public protest were recently added to the already controversial policing bill, and it might also become illegal to boycott, divest and sanction entities like Israel, robbing public bodies of their right to make ethical decisions. It's the information age, and it remains to be seen how the UK hopes to maintain its democratic persona now that its grip on the media has loosened. Bianca Rahimi, London.
As higher oil prices mean more oil pumping, all of the big names of Iran's oil industry have assembled here to multiply the country's oil output amid rising crude prices. The 26th edition of the International Oil, Gas, Refining and Petrochemical Exhibition brought together 1,200 Iranian and 44 international firms active in upstream, midstream and downstream oil sectors.
We produce a range of medium pressure and high pressure cables, lead sheet head cables for use in petrochemical industries and oil and gas. We have been operating since 1992 and have been supplying our domestic oil firms with our cables, which otherwise would have to go through the process of importing from other countries amid the complications caused by the sanctions.
Our company has been running for 39 years in the production of more than 400 types of metal fasteners and holders from various materials such as iron, copper, aluminium, stainless steel and alloy, among others. We have worked with major foreign companies supplying them with insulation, pipe clamps, cold line shoes, and so on.
For decades, Iran has relied on drilling bits produced by the U.S. and China to pump its crude. But U.S. oil embargoes on Iran have made it almost impossible to import quality bits, among other oil exploration and production equipment. This has forced Iran to try its own know-how to build its needed machinery, including drilling bits.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
NATO critics say the alliance's expansion is what led to the war in Ukraine, and now moves are afoot to provoke Moscow even further. It looks almost certain that Finland, and most probably Sweden, are to join NATO. Via video link, senior Helsinki officials set out their case to the European Parliament on Thursday as to why Finland would fit right in.
Finland has many high-end capabilities, including a fighter jet fleet of F-80s, gradually to be replaced by recently ordered 64 F-35 jet fighters.
Sweden's Malin Björk asked, what's the rush given that her country and Finland have said they don't feel under immediate threat? However, it seems most EU lawmakers are supportive.
We think that it is not only defining for Finnish security, but it's only an important step in European history.
Finland's border with Russia stretches for 1,300 kilometres. Membership would mean NATO's land border with the Federation would more than double. The Kremlin has warned there will be military retaliation if the plan goes ahead. Experts aren't ruling out the possibility of World War III.
This creates a major problem, because when you change the architecture of security, of course, you create waves of reaction and perceived threats, which is the case for Russia now.
The US and its European allies are spending enormous amounts of money on arming Ukraine. One EU lawmaker criticized this during Thursday's proceedings.
We have a very powerful arms industry in the European Union, and many nations rely on arms exports. We should be doing all we can to prevent conflicts escalating instead.
Analysts say it could take up to a year for Finland to fully join NATO, but in the meantime, it will become a de facto member. The question is, in the event of escalation, will it be viewed as protected or as a target? Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Supplication on Thursdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who has taken away the shadowy night by His power and brought the sight-giving day through His mercy. He has clothed me in its brightness and given me its favor. O Allah, just as Thou hast spared me for this day, so also spare me for its likes. Bless the Prophet Muhammad and his household, and torment me not in it and in other nights and days by allowing me to commit unlawful acts and to clothe myself in sins. Provide me with its good, the good of all within it, and the good of everything after it, and turn away from me its evil, the evil of all within it, and the evil of everything after it. O Allah, by the protective compact of Islam, I seek mediation with Thee, and by the inviolability of the Quran, I rely upon Thee. By Muhammad, the Chosen, Allah bless him and his household, I seek intercession with Thee. So recognize my protective compact, by which I hope my need will be granted. O most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, decree for me on Thursday five things, which none embraces but thy generosity, and none supports but thy favors. Health through which I may have the strength to obey thee. Worship by which I may deserve thy plentiful reward. Plenty in my state through lawful provision. And that thou makest me secure in the places of fear through thy security. And placest me in thy fortress against the striking of worries and sorrows. Bless Muhammad and his household. And make my seeking his mediation as an intercessor give profits on the day of resurrection. Surely, thou art the most merciful of the merciful.
Now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
The surge in the cost of living in the UK is taking a heavy toll on the people's health. According to a YouGov poll, 55% of Britons complain about the worsening health due to such factors as heating and food costs. Retailers have also warned that food price inflation could hit 10% in Britain this year. The Bank of England governor has admitted he is unable to stop inflation hitting 10%.
The UK government's latest data shows the unemployment rate has fallen to a new five-decade low, with the value of wages going down amid rising inflation. The governor of the Bank of England, Andrew Bailey, says the two main drivers of inflation are energy and global goods prices resulting from the Ukraine war. He has warned that the fallout from surging prices will cause unemployment to increase. He described the situation surrounding soaring food costs as apocalyptic.
I'm afraid the one that I am going to sound, I guess, rather apocalyptic about is food. I think two things that the Ukrainian finance minister said. One is Ukraine does have food in store, but it can't get it out at the moment. Two, while he was optimistic about crop planting, he was pretty optimistic about planting, interestingly, but he said at the moment, you know, we have no way of shipping it out.
Bailey also warned of a very real income shock. While average wages are rising in the UK, the government says they continue to sink in real terms as Britain, like others, faces runaway inflation. The Bank of England also warned that Brexit has made the bad situation worse, saying that leaving the EU will continue to have a negative effect on the economy. Consumer price inflation was at 7% last month, the highest in 30 years, while the energy price cap rose by 54%. The Bank of England expects further price rise will push the economy close to recession by the end of 2022. It says the inflation may top 10% by December. A British think tank, Resolution Foundation, has warned that UK households are facing a cost of living catastrophe. A survey conducted by Ipsos also shows that one in three Brits say they have missed meals recently because of surging inflation. According to the poll, two in three people in the country are turning off their heating system. The surge has also taken a heavy toll on the health sector, with 55% of Britons surveyed saying their health has worsened due to the skyrocketing cost of living. Chancellor of Exchequer Rishi Sunak has raised pressure to do more now to address the crisis facing many households. The Bank of England has already raised its interest rate to tackle the prices. Its key rate now stands at the highest level since the global financial crisis in 2009. But analysts say that's too little, too late.
So the Bank of England missed the opportunity to avoid all this some time ago. All right, it should have been raising interest rates substantially some time ago. All right, and it's too little, too late. And in fact, this 1% is not going to make any difference. All right, interest rates at 1% with inflation headed to 10. As I say, in economics, we call it a negative real return of 9%. All right. So in fact, you've got savers are getting killed. All right, because they're earning 1%, but the cost of living is going up 10.
Millions in Britain now face one big question. How to make ends meet, as many believe the crisis has barely begun and the situation will get much worse in the coming weeks and months.
Welcome to The Spotlight. I'm your host, Behrouz Najafi, and as you've noticed, we're going to discuss British economic woes. Let me introduce our guests in this episode. Journalist, author, and activist Fra Hughes is joining us out of Belfast. With us, we'll also have historian and investigative journalist Tony Gosling in Bristol.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Now, Fra, let me start asking you this question. The BOE governor mentioned that rising prices for energy and goods as cause of inflation. He stressed the shocks such as the Russian invasion of Ukraine and also the impact of China's zero COVID policy. Now, what factors do you blame for the situation in the UK?
Well, I believe that what we're maybe witnessing now is also part of the capitalist global kind of boom bust that comes along every 10 years. I mean, it was 2007 since the last real recession came in because of the kind of financial irregularities around the subprime housing market in America and stuff. In Britain at the minute, housing is probably higher than it was before the previous financial collapse. So I think it's worth maybe repeating that, you know, with the Bank of England interest rates only at 1%, it still means that people can borrow money at very low rates. And as people begin to struggle to pay their bills and to meet their commitments, and the rent sector is beginning to go through the roof. So we've got, you know, high house prices, very high rent, stagnant wages, inflation going up. Money is still relatively easy to get on credit, which in itself could become a long-term time bomb for the people who find themselves in difficulty. But it's a neoliberal austerity that's been followed by the Conservative Party, perhaps, and the Labour Party, actually from Margaret Thatcher for nearly 40 years, that have led to the demise of public services, the health service, education. I think it's almost like a perfect storm that with inflation going up and alongside the kind of extraordinary rise in energy prices and the government refusing to bring in a windfall tax on the money that's being made by the energy utilities in order to defer the price raises for the average consumer and the families in Britain. I think, to paraphrase what the governor of the Bank of England said, is apocalyptic. We have more food banks than we've ever had. We have more homeless people than we've ever had. And if employment does rise, then you will find more people in difficulty with their mortgages. You will find more house repossessions. You will find more families breaking up due to the financial strain. You'll have more children hungry going to school. It's a nightmare in the making, and a lot of it could be pointed at America's coup in Ukraine in 2014. And when America can afford to give $44 billion in weapons, lethal aid to the Ukraine, what does that say about the people who are suffering under the economic sanctions that are rebounding in Western Europe and America due to their short-sighted political falling and falling out with Russia that is causing all these problems for their own citizens?
Okay. Well, yes, for as you just mentioned, there are many, many factors involved. We'll discuss some of them in more details later on in the show. Now, Tony, the Bank of England also saying that the Brexit has made a bad situation worse. So what do you think about the impact of this Brexit and divorce deal on the British economy?
Isn't it interesting? Because the previous governor of the Bank of England said he thought Brexit was going to make almost no difference whatsoever to the British economy, because things would still be being traded across the Channel, and that it is the much bigger factors that will make things, for example, these massive sanctions on Russia. Because the way this is being framed is that it's the Ukrainian war that's caused this. No, it's the reaction to the Ukrainian war by the West. Britain particularly has spearheaded this reaction. That is to say, boycotting all these necessities that Britain and the rest of the West need from Russia. So in a way, they've brought this situation upon themselves by overreacting. But I also want to say, this isn't just a one-off. It's not an accident. This is something that's been being framed for years. And if you look just, you know, back 6 months or so, we saw two things happening. One was a big warning back in August, September here in 2021 in the UK that there was going to be a massive hike in fuel prices. Well, no explanation was given for that, but we now know what's happened. We also had all the troops brought back from Afghanistan. Nobody was really told why that was, but now we know. And that is because the West was preparing the provocation of the invasion of the Donbass in Ukraine right the way back at the autumn of last year. And they knew that the Russians would have to react as NATO and the Ukrainian army prepared to invade the Donbass in Ukraine. And so I think they knew that all this was going to happen, and it's been prepared. So the main, I also agree with Finian very much that rent plays a very important part. We keep hearing about the increase in fuel prices, the energy prices going up 50%. It's roughly 25% for the petrol and diesel prices. But actually, rent is the killer. And rent is so ridiculously high in Britain. It's the average, right? And that is including the people who own their own homes. Is one-third of people's income they're having to spend on their rent. So they've got very little, and that is mortgage repayments too. Mm-hmm. So they've got very little. Most of the population have got very little. Many have got nothing left after they've finished paying their rent. So the idea that these other things like energy and fuel are going up has basically tipped them underneath, basically put them into the red. You know, so they are now unable, through going to work, to pay enough money to live. Mm-hmm. And this is a deadly serious situation. And, of course, it means that they won't be paying tax. Therefore, the government is going to have less tax revenue and the government's going to go further into the black. Yeah. But we've just had this week an announcement from Jacob Rees-Mogg, the Conservative MP, chairman of the Privy Council, and he was the leader of the House as well, Conservative, of course, that we're going to be sacking 90,000 civil servants. So that's taking a fantastic amount out of the economy again. That money that those civil servants would have been paid, would have been spending. And so there, it seems to me as if they're deliberately, basically committing harakiri, suiciding the economy. Alex Craner, the analyst, he's a former hedge fund manager, was saying it's like a suicide pact. And the catalyst for all of this over the last few months has been the deliberate imposition of massive sanctions on Russia, even though, of course, Ukraine is not a NATO country. And, you know, that, I think, is basically what's going on. And Britain is the fifth richest country in the world, according to most of the metrics. And so what, if you look at it, if you take a step back at this and look, right, what you'll see is that the what's happening is the wealth is being hoarded by the wealthy. They're using their lobbying power and wealth in order to impoverish the rest of the nation. So it's setting the rich against the poor, and the divide is getting bigger and bigger by the minute.
Yeah. Now, Fra, there are some people who argue that the worst is yet to come for Britain, you know, citing the post-Brexit tensions that are growing wider with the EU over the Northern Ireland Agreement. You know, the administration talked about making some changes to the protocol, and the EU is warning against it, and also warning of harsh repercussions for that.
Yes, well, we've had, I live in Belfast, so we've had Boris Johnson visiting yesterday. It's interesting that he chose to visit the Thales armament factory in East Belfast. They make component parts for the Javelin missiles, I think they're anti-tank missiles. So he was over cheering on the boys and girls making the bombs and the missiles that are going to be used on Russian soldiers and the people defending the Donbass against the fascist incursions from Kiev. But I think what we have here and what we're witnessing is this, in many respects, is just normal politics. This is Boris Johnson, Liz Truss, and it's also Geoffrey Donaldson of the Democratic Unionist Party here in the north of Ireland. They are just playing a game of chicken and brinkmanship, and this is very well Boris Johnson. Cause the destabilised peace process here, and that is caused by the implementation of the Northern Ireland Protocol, that will have to change. But what we're talking about is a small rump of loyalist, extremist, reactionary paramilitaries who would rather die than see there be some form of a second-class citizenship for them within the United Kingdom. And we have Geoffrey Donaldson and the DUP refusing to go into government with Sinn Féin and the other parties until the protocol is scrapped. So Boris Johnson and Liz Truss several weeks ago said they were going to rip up the Northern Ireland Protocol, that they were going to bring in legislation that would supersede that international agreement. Now they're saying that they want to continue talks with the EU to settle the outstanding issues, and that basically their legislation would be an insurance policy. But it's really a threat to the EU. Do what we want or we will act unilaterally. I don't believe for a second Boris Johnson and the United Kingdom Parliament and Cabinet will do that. And I feel that Boris Johnson, along with the choreography that's taking place here, are just trying to use the leverage of the threat of violence here in the north of Ireland to force the EU's hand. And I think they're following along suggestions from the DUP that we don't need to have border checks on the island of Ireland. We don't need to have a hard border within Ireland, that there can be some form of electronic monitoring of vehicles and goods travelling from the north of Ireland to the south of Ireland. But I don't believe that the British government fully intends to change the Northern Ireland Protocol. It's just politics and bluff and bluster.
Okay. Now, Tony, Bank of England was also blaming this Russia-Ukraine war for some of the woes in the British economy. But the UK was already facing energy price hikes even before the Russian military operation began in Ukraine, if you remember. So what was responsible for that issue? And then how did it spiral into this situation we're facing now?
Well, I mean, we didn't really have much in the way of price hikes in terms of energy. It was just that it was announced that the United States would be supplying more of our energy. And the Russians would be supplying less. That was announced last year. So goodness knows why. I think they want to kind of put, for the Americans, they want to put sanctions on Russia. But I have to disagree about the protocol, the Northern Ireland Protocol. I think this is going to go. At the moment, there's a sizable, it's difficult to know whether it's a majority or a minority. And it doesn't, and it includes some people from both of the different sides of the divide. That is to say, the nationalist community in Northern Ireland, who want to generally want to stay with Ireland, They were going to send migrants who came across the English Channel from France over to Rwanda. It basically hasn't happened. It's an empty announcement. And this really does explain how I think it illustrates how little power the British government really has and how little handle Boris Johnson has on the nation. I don't think he has. People who are really running things over here are the big corporations, the oil companies that put a fuel crisis on at the time of the party political broadcasts last year, the party conferences, sorry. We had these fuel price hikes almost to send a message to the political parties about who's really in charge. And when you've got weak government, it's the banks, the banksters, the City of London and the big corporations who are really in charge. At the end of the day, though, we've got 500,000 children now in absolute poverty. That means that the parents have to start claiming benefits, food banks, things like this in order to feed their children. And this is, as I say, the fifth richest country in the world. So it's clear what's going on. The rich are just starving the poor. And we've got, as a so-called answer to all of this here in Bristol, I was very amused the other day to see they're putting up signs in Southmead, which is one of the poorest districts in the city, with smiling faces on, saying, "Be happy, this is our happy city." In fact, there's even an organisation which is putting these happy city messages out. And of course, this is what the government, in its very patronising manner, has been funding, and our local government here in Bristol, in order to sort of tell people, it's OK, it doesn't matter if you're in poverty and you've got no prospects for your children's future, you can just smile and be happy. So it's horrifically horrifically patronising. So I think the main culprits behind all this, of course, are the City of London. They are running the country for their own private profit and as a investment place, and they've really lost sight of the needs and the interests of the population.
OK. Now, we have 1 or 2 minutes left. Fra, there is this YouGov poll indicating the cost of living taking a heavy toll on people's health. 55% of Britons say their health has worsened due to heating and food costs. So what measures has Downing Street taken to address those issues?
Well, I don't think it's taken any. As I mentioned earlier on, there's no windfall tax, which you would think would be the first thing a government that's concerned about its citizens would bring in. I mean, huge, huge, almost immoral, obscene profits are being made by these utility companies, and nothing is being given back to the people. I can imagine, I mean, even long before this in Britain, every winter, there were thousands of senior citizens who are maybe on a basic state pension, who had to decide between heating their homes and in eating their dinner. And people would die each year. People were found in their homes with the heating turned off because they'd either run out of money or couldn't afford it. And they were just sitting in their front rooms or lying in bed with extra blankets and extra coats to try and keep them warm. I can understand how people's health is beginning to suffer because if you're under stress, financial strain, you're worried about how you're going to put food on the table for your children, how you're going to clothe your kids, how you're going to sort out their extra curricular school activities. I mean, stress is probably one of the biggest inducers of strokes, heart attacks and suicides in Western Europe, in first world countries. So I think that this huge burden that the government is placing onto the shoulders of its citizens is going to have a devastating...
Okay, we're running out of time. Tony, only 30 seconds. Sorry, Frava, jumping in. 30 seconds.
Use the word apocalyptic to describe the food shortages potentially in the future. Now, this is a very important word. He's not used this word accidentally. This is a biblical reference to the book of Revelation, the four horsemen of the apocalypse. And what worries me is that actually the third horse, the black horse, if you go down to the Bible and have a look, talks about food shortages. It talks about massive rising prices for basic foods, and it talks about famine. So I think we should take his warning seriously. What he's basically, I think, signalling is that he doesn't have any ability to control this situation now, and it may well be running out of control. And we may be looking at, literally, the sorts of signs that are written about in the New Testament about the horrific kind of situation that could bring about a kind of crisis in the whole of civilization.
Sorry for jumping.
So,
that's
interesting word to
have,
use, isn't it? Apocalyptic.
I'm sorry for interrupting. That's all the time we have. Journalist, author, and activist Fra Hugh joined me from Belfast. Historian, investigative journalist Tony Gosling from Bristol with their insight.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The limelight. President Biden was livid. He had been in office only 2 months and there was already a crisis at the southwest border of the United States. Thousands of migrant children were jammed into unsanitary border patrol stations. Republicans were accusing Mr. Biden of flinging open the borders, and his aides were blaming one another. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalists Zolan Kano Young, Michael Shear, and Eileen Sullivan. The piece is titled Disagreement and Delay: How Infighting Over the Border Divided the White House. President Biden was livid. He had only been in office for 2 months, and there was already a crisis at the southwest border of the United States. Thousands of migrant children were jammed into unsanitary border patrol stations. Republicans were accusing Mr. Biden of flinging open the borders, and his aides were blaming one another. Facing his bickering staff in the Oval Office, that day in late March 2021, Joe Biden grew so angry at their attempts to duck responsibility that he erupted. "Who do I need to fire," he demanded, "to fix this?" Joe Biden came into office promising to dismantle what he described as the inhumane immigration policies of his predecessor, Donald J. Trump. But the episode, recounted by several people who attended or were briefed on the meeting, helps explain why that effort remains incomplete. For much of Joe Biden's presidency so far, the White House has been divided by furious debates over how and whether to proceed in the face of a surge of migrants crossing the southwest border of the United States. Senior Biden aides have been battling one another over how quickly to roll back the most restrictive policies and what kind of system would best replace them. Now Mr. Biden finds himself the target of attacks from all sides. Immigration activists accuse him of failing to prioritize the human rights of millions of immigrants. Conservatives have pointed to surges of migrants at the border as evidence that the president is weak and ineffective. And even some moderate Democrats now fear that lifting Trump-era border restrictions could hurt them politically. Officials from the Department of Homeland Security expect record numbers of migrants to cross the border this summer, just months ahead of the midterm elections that will determine control of Congress and help shape the arc of Joe Biden's presidency for the next 2 years. This account of the Biden administration's handling of the border over the past 15 months is based on interviews with 20 current and former officials, lawmakers and activists, most of whom requested anonymity to discuss private deliberations. President Biden came into office with high hopes, saying he wanted a system that would allow the United States to determine in a more compassionate way which migrants should be allowed to stay in the country. He recruited a team of immigration advocates and others eager to put in place the humane system they had envisioned for years. But the slow pace of change has left some of Joe Biden's longtime allies doubting his commitment and wondering whether he is more interested in keeping the highly charged issue from dominating his presidency. Virtually all of the aides who came on board early in the Biden administration have left the White House, frustrated by what they describe as repeated fights with some of the president's most senior advisers over whether to lift Trump-era policies. Even some of Joe Biden's more enforcement-minded aides have departed. White House officials did not dispute the internal disagreements over immigration. Vedant Patel, a spokesman for Mr. Biden, said the president understood that changing an outdated system was not going to happen overnight. Though he said, Joe Biden was working every day to secure our border and use the power we do have to build a fair, orderly and humane immigration system. But the border has been a constant headache for President Biden, one that ballooned into a series of crises even as he tried to stay focused on the coronavirus pandemic, the economy, Afghanistan, and the conflict in Ukraine. Our old debates about border security and deterrence and open borders are not capturing the actual policy challenge at hand, said Andrea Flores, who resigned as a director for border management at the National Security Council, disillusioned and frustrated by senior aides and the opportunities I saw them not take. Ron Klain issued a warning to his staff last summer. The White House Chief of Staff, Ron Klain, gathered senior aides including Susan Rice, the President's domestic policy advisor, Elizabeth Sherwood Randall, the Homeland Security advisor, and Amy Pope, the top migration advisor, in the Roosevelt Room. Ron Klain told them that they needed to make sure the administration was not pandering to people who wanted an immediate end to Trump-era border restrictions, according to two people familiar with his comments. If they did not find a way to deter soaring illegal crossings at the southwest border of the United States, he said, accusations about border chaos would grow worse, anger moderate voters, and potentially sink the party during the 2022 midterm elections. The White House Chief of Staff, Ron Klain, was channeling his boss, who had complained to top aides about the intensifying attacks from Republicans, characterizing him as an open border president, according to a person familiar with Mr. Biden's comments. But the source of President's frustration was as much from inside his administration as it was from outside. As border crossings increased, disagreements erupted over how quickly to dismantle Donald Trump's anti-immigrant policies and what to replace them with. Record numbers of migrants, including people driven out of their homes in Central America by the economic effects of the pandemic, gangs and natural disasters, surged to the border last summer, in part enticed by Joe Biden's promise of a less harsh approach to immigration than that of his predecessor. About 214,000 migrants were taken into custody in July of last year, the first time that many people had been apprehended in a single month in more than two decades. Joe Biden has taken a series of actions to reverse his predecessor's policies. He halted construction of the border wall, created a task force to reunite families separated at the border, and reversed Donald Trump's ban on considering domestic violence or gang violence as a basis for asylum. He also proposed sweeping legislation to overhaul the nation's immigration system, though it has stalled in Congress. But despite those actions, the infighting among the president's aides was on full display during the Oval Office meeting last March. Xavier Becerra, the Secretary of Health and Human Services, whose department runs shelters for migrant children, said the Department of Homeland Security needed to be aggressive in turning away older teenagers, which would have changed President Biden's policy of letting all unaccompanied migrant children into the country. Ms. Rice repeatedly said that Xavier Becerra should provide more shelters. Alejandro Mayorkas, the Secretary of Homeland Security, said the Department of Health and Human Services needed to move the children more quickly out of overcrowded Border Patrol stations. Ron Klain, the White House Chief of Staff, tried to play the mediator, to little effect. For months, aides clashed over an effort intended to speed up consideration of asylum cases at the border by allowing immigration officers to decide the claims rather than the overburdened judges. The goal was to streamline a court process that currently takes an average of 5 years to reach a decision for asylum seekers. Some of the former immigration advocates in the West Wing, including Ms. Rice's deputy for immigration, Esther Olivaria, worried that rushing through the new process would limit due process for migrants. Ms. Rice, Ron Klain, and others argued that processing claims faster, swiftly deporting migrants who fail to win asylum, was an important way to ease the burden on the system and deter illegal crossings. As the year went on, Joe Biden grew annoyed by the delays in putting the asylum changes into practice along the U.S. border with Mexico. In meetings on immigration with his top aides, he often asked what resources and funding the team of former advocates and immigration veterans needed for the policy. The administration did not release the final language for the new policy until last month. And because of staffing and funding issues, the plan will be rolled out slowly and not in time to offer significant help with the expected spike in migrants seeking asylum later on this spring. One of the most fraught debates inside the West Wing over the last year has been what to do about Donald Trump's Remain in Mexico policy, which forced migrants seeking asylum to wait south of the border until their cases were decided. Human rights advocates assailed the conditions in Mexico, where migrants often stayed in squalid camps, where they had no legal representation and were at risk of assault. As a candidate, Joe Biden had condemned the program. Once in office, he quickly terminated it. But it was one program that had been effective at keeping some migrants out of border detention facilities. During a meeting last summer convened to discuss options for dealing with the record numbers of migrants at the U.S. border, Ms. Sherwood Randall raised the possibility of restoring the program with some additional protections for migrants, according to two people familiar with the matter. That idea horrified immigration advocates inside the Biden administration, who viewed it not only as a breach of Joe Biden's campaign pledge, but also as a retreat from the promise of a more humane immigration system. Joe Biden, too, appeared uncomfortable with the idea, according to a person who was in the room for the meeting. The president told his team he would not forbid them to explore whether it was worth restoring the Remain in Mexico policy, but he made it clear that he did not want the idea leaking to the news media, and he did not want his name attached to it. The Supreme Court would later force the Biden administration to restore the Trump-era policy.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.